everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Indie Film Cafe. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I've got my co-host here. How are you doing, Paul Prezenza?
I'm doing pretty good. Paulie Prezenza here, otherwise known as the Moo Cow. Moo, everybody. With the monkey, as always.
Yep, you're with Continuity Monkey. I'm surprised. I thought he was back at the studio, but, you know.
Oh, I gave him a break. I let him come home for a while.
All right, good. We have a special guest. She has never been on this show before, but she has been on Indie Corner Radio with me, and we've been friends for a while, and so I was like, let's rope her into one of these episodes. Please welcome Taylor Kilgore. How are you doing, Taylor?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me again on a different show.
Welcome to the jungle.
Yes, exactly. We're here to talk about a little film from 1991 called Lunatics, A Love Story. And from that title, you can sort of guess what it might be about. And we'll talk about that in a bit after a little bit of moon music. And we are back. Let's talk real quick about this. Let's get right into it. Basically, this film was made in 1990.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1990. It was released in 91.
It reeks of 1990.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely did.
And Josh Becker is the writer director, and we've never done Josh Becker on our show yet. So this was our first one. And I think honestly, out of all the Josh Becker movies, this is kind of like a fun one to do, because it's not like Thou Shalt Not Kill except crazy. And it's not as like, I mean, I don't know, Running Time gets a lot of attention too for that. And it's definitely not Alien Apocalypse. So there you go. Josh Becker, he worked with Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert on the Evil Dead movie, as well as he worked on plenty of other movies with them. Sam actually helped finance Thou Shalt Not Kill except if I'm correct, or at least produced and he acted in it. And so he went to Sam and Rob when they had Renaissance Pictures, and he asked them basically to fund his next movie, which at the time he was trying to think of an idea. So he came up with Lunatics, A Love Story. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah. And okay. I was just going to say, I think this was Renaissance's first picture, wasn't it?
I think Darkman might have been their first picture. They were working on Darkman at the same exact time, you know. So basically Renaissance Pictures had he had asked them, they paid him $2,500 for the first script, then $500 after for each draft. However, they only got up to about four drafts before they said, we can't pay you any more money. And the typical Hollywood response would be, well, I guess this movie's not getting made then. But Josh really, really, really wanted to, and said, I will write it for free. You guys can give me notes. And he wrote 11 drafts of the script. However, the funny thing is, after the fifth draft, it took a different turn completely, even different than the tone that it's right now. And Bruce Campbell John Cameron and Dave Goodman. Dave Goodman and Bruce Campbell were both like, hey, this isn't the story you guys kind of told me. And he was like, after the fifth draft, it took a different take. They're like, let me read the fifth draft. They read that and they said, let's do this one, you know? And they went to Rob, and Rob said, okay, sure. And they made, you know, based on this draft. So I did a lot of research on this film, if you guys can notice. So I'm going to let more people talk in a second, but this was, you know, kind of a big deal for Josh. You know, it was his second feature film and one that actually had like a real crew, you know, doing stuff, not just him doing stuff with like his friends, you know, so it was amazing.
And it had claymation.
A little claymation. It had
I was wondering if that was clay. I wasn't 100% sure, but I thought it was.
Yeah, that claymation. It had a lot of cool stuff in it. So let's get into like the story, you know, of it. Taylor, we sometimes ask our guests if they could like kind of tell us like a brief story synopsis of what you would say this movie is about.
I would say this movie is about two parties who have their own they're living in their own world. They have their own kind of like issue going on. Oh, that's hard. I'm trying to think of a good summary for it.
Two misfits.
Yeah. Basically two misfits and how they're kind of outcast from society and what it's like in their daily lives for them. And then them meeting, of course, and crossing paths and how the misfits kind of fit together, but don't at the same time.
Exactly. That's a great example of it. I think he had summarized this as like when he first thought of the idea, he wanted to do a movie called Lunatic. And then he was like, what if I pluralize it and make it Lunatics? And then what if I make it that it's they both fall in love with each boy and girl and they fall in love with each other and make it a love story? So that's pretty much what it is. Like he doesn't want to go out because he's, you know, too crazy and everything. And she can't go in, you know, which was sort of what happened. I mean, she can go in. She can't go in anywhere else because she has no place to go, you know, but, you know, she has nowhere to live or anything, but he can't, you know, he does. So she comes and stays with him, you know. What did you think, Paul? What did you think of the story?
It was interesting. And I guess this is going to open up a whole discussion that I was going to table for later, but I guess it's all right. This movie reminds me an awful, awful lot of Martin Scorsese's After Hours. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's very similar where you've got this sort of nebbishy kind of guy. He doesn't quite look like Milhouse, like Ted Raimi does in this. But, you know, he spends an entire evening chasing after this beautiful young girl that he's never met and that he wants to meet. And he's going to go through all of these things in order to finally get to him. And of course, Scorsese has a much bigger budget, much bigger people. So he kind of does it in a different way. This is like kind of a mini version of that, except, of course, it's 5 years later. And like I was telling Jonathan earlier, it is absolutely steeped in the year 1990 from the music and the you know, colors and the gangs. I mean, when the gang showed up, I'm like, wow, is that in living color? Because they were like, okay, I don't remember any gang ever looking like that except on television.
Yeah.
But you know, it was pretty neat. I think the reason this movie works as well as it does, in my opinion, comes down to Ted Raimi and Deborah Foreman. I just think the both of them together were just fantastic. They both put on really, really good performances. Ted Raimi doesn't really get a whole lot of opportunities to be a leading man, unfortunately. And I think this was a movie that really shows his range and shows the kind of stuff he can do. Deborah Foreman is just always, always wonderful. She's wonderful in every movie I've ever seen in her. She's been one of my favorite actresses of the period. And it's a shame because while I hadn't seen this movie previously, a lot of people at the time I remember were saying, you should check this out. This is your kind of film. I just never got around to it. Mm-hmm. But I did see the other movie she shot, I think it was the year before, called Lobster Men from Mars, which I have. And yes, we are going to do that on IFC. But she did that movie. She did this movie. And then poof, she vanished for like 15 years.
Paul, I think.
And it was a shame. I was always looking out for Deborah Foreman. I have to get her on our spotlight show and interview her because, you know, she was one of my favorite actresses of the period, and she's really good all the time, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
There's no information on where she might be or why she's got projects.
She has her own webpage, and she's doing a whole lot of other stuff now that don't involve acting. So I don't know whether she just had some kind of exegesis about not wanting to act anymore or something, just doing other things. But there's probably a story behind it. But, you know, I always regretted not seeing her. I think she ended up being in a movie later on, like 2007. She kind of came back. But I don't know that she's doing much now. And I miss Deborah Foreman. I always liked her.
I feel like it might be like a Barbara Crampton type thing where she just took time with her family and kind of left it for a little bit. But maybe we need like an Adam Wingard from like Your Next to kind of come back and say, hey, you know, we would love you to come back and act in another film because we love you. It. And yeah, I guess we got to be those guys, maybe, you know.
Oh, yeah. I remember I went out in the theaters and I saw Valley Girl. And while I loved seeing Nicolas Cage and everybody talk about Nicolas Cage, it was Deborah Foreman who blew me away in that movie. Blew me away. And I was like, wow, I have to see everything she's ever, ever, ever going to do. And I pretty much tried to.
Well, there you go. This was one on your bucket list and you can cross it off, which I'm very surprised. I thought you had seen this movie. So
No, it had been one of the ones that, like I said, I was going to see, I never got around to it and I forgot that it existed because cow brain.
Oh, hey, I'm glad we did it on IFC just so you can watch it.
After 40, you forget everything. Just you wait, kids.
I already forget everything. So I guess I'm well on my way.
Poor Taylor.
Yeah. So Taylor, so you had never heard of this movie at all, right?
I had not.
Was this something like when you were watching it, you're like, oh, wow, I'm actually surprised, you know, like with the title and then with everything else that you've seen on it?
I was definitely just like the first thoughts, like this is very 90s. That was my first thought. I was like, oh, wow, this is super 90s because I didn't even notice it in the title. I didn't watch a trailer or anything because that's just on a personal preference. I don't typically like watching trailers for movies because I feel like they give away too much I will try to if they give away too much, I can figure out usually what happens in the movie. And I don't like doing that. I can't like turn my brain off. So I didn't watch the trailer.
I'm with you 100%, Taylor. I despise trailers.
Yeah, so it's like if someone gives me a little brief summary of their part, then I, you know, I have my own imagination and then I see it and it's completely different. So it's great. but yeah, I definitely, I really wasn't sure what to expect. I was just looking forward to it because you said it was different than movies you had done in the past that you guys had reviewed. So I was like, oh, okay.
Well, it was different in the sense that this was like a very well-made film, like for a low budget film. It's like this quality. Yeah, it's got a lot of quality to it, you know, which
what was the budget?
$600,000. Yeah. Now that was 1990 money.
Right. So and that's 600K well spent, by the way.
Yeah.
So nowadays it would probably be at least $1 million, $2 million for what they probably went through. I mean, with everything, even like special effects, like my favorite scene is just the shot of the crown cracking open and things getting sucked down and everything. I was like, for a low budget film like this, that is just remarkable that they were able to do that. You know?
Yeah. He actually picked you a nice, easy one. It's good because if it had been me, I'd have picked you a real stinker and you'd have been like, oh my God, what have I got myself into?
Yeah.
Well, at least I would have laughed, you know, every once in a while I watch a really crappy movie and I'm like, oh wow, that's really bad. I could fall asleep and wake up and I'm like, oh, I didn't miss anything.
Not for this movie. I mean, no. and there's a lot that goes into it. So I guess we'll talk more about the story a little bit, kind of go into like scenes and stuff. And like the beginning of the movie, it involves I'm trying to remember what the first scene was. The people at the, you know, apartment complex, the old ladies at the apartment complex. They're just like, you know, talking to the mail person and, you know, and everything and telling her she's too late. I thought that was hilarious. Like all the old ladies, I kind of wish there was more of them in the movie a little bit. Like they were throughout, like sprinkled, you know, whatever. Yeah. But did you notice that the, you know how they say if you introduce a gun in Act One, I'm not talking about a literal gun, but like they say you introduce a gun into Act One, you have to have it go off in Act Three. That's what happens when the guy, the old man is like talking about this guy who, you know, when he came out of his apartment after like, you know, a while, he started killing everybody. Then they meet him, he meets him and he goes, "Oh, you came out of your apartment. Okay, never mind. I'm going back in my apartment."
Yeah, that was cute.
Yeah. This movie is, to me, is so cute. Like, it's nothing but cute. Were you going to say, Paul?
I was going to say, it is definitely cute. Definitely rooting for them because they are such misfits. And it's always a great fantasy to have two people who are different than everybody else who get to meet up. And, you know, I mean, everyone has that fantasy. I've had that fantasy myself. There are a couple of things issues that I do have with it. You know, for example, he punches her. And yes. At that point,
I was very caught off guard by that. I was not expecting that.
And I understand he's nuts, but so it doesn't mean it, but boy, that's an awfully hard thing to come back from. And yet she manages to sort of, I don't want to say forget, but forgive. A little quick, if you ask me. I don't know. That was one of my main issues. But
I thought about that for a second, and then my only thought about it was that he punches her when he's choking himself. Like, he's obviously not in his right mind at that particular moment. So when he does it, I think she knows he did not do that maliciously. Like, he wasn't planning to punch her. He was literally thinking she was something else, and she could tell. I think she just at that point, she was just like, I got to get out of here. This guy is nuts and I can't trust myself around him because I don't know if he's going to do, you know, if he's going to hurt himself or hurt me. You know what I mean? Like, he's just too much. And she does try to leave again, right? Like, at that
point. Oh, yeah. And matter of fact, when he catches up with her, the movie's very consistent about that. And I'm happy to say that, because when he catches up with her, she's like, yeah, I'm not going back. You're too nuts. Stay away from me. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It isn't until, you know, she's between the rock and the hard place where now you got these ridiculous thugs. You know, the other thing I didn't really care for about it.
They were a bit goofy. Whenever she got punched, I thought it was amnesia. So when she stood up, just the look on her face, I thought that she didn't know that she got punched. So for me, I didn't even think about, the situation that you guys are like.
That might have been the case too.
See, I thought about that, but the thing is, they have not established that in the film to this point. You know, if she had come where she maybe mentioned that she'd forgotten things easily or had, you know, you know what I mean? If that had been established in that, I could have bought that. But since they didn't do that, I have to sort of fill it in logically best I can. And to me, it was a little too forgiving.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess she could have, I don't know. What I liked about that was, I mean, I hated that she got punched because I was like, ouch. Just the same as I hated that dog died.
She's Deborah Foreman. She's gorgeous.
Hey, but she did say she like causes like chaos all around her and stuff. Everything that she touches cursed. So that includes herself, you know.
But she's not cursed. The plant. She saves the plant.
Yeah, I like that line. Yeah, I love that line where she's like, you know, if it needs to get warm, I can just heat it up. It's got put in the, was the crock pot or something?
It was so goofy.
It was cute. I mean, like, that's the only thing he has that resembles anything that could fit a plant, and he gives it to her, you know. Like, he could have just, most of the time I kept thinking this guy could be a dick, you know. Like, had she come to his house and he was just like kind of just like Bruce Campbell, she was used to like assholes, you know. Like, her last boyfriend was the biggest dick in the world, which I mean I kind of still liked his character a lot, you know, even though he's a dick.
Oh, that's because it's Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, his line, that was my, I think that was my favorite part of the movie, where he's at the car and right before he gets hit in the head by the I forget what it was that got thrown.
The bat.
Yeah, his line, it just made me laugh. I it was just like, it was just it was also like, because we hadn't seen him in a minute, so I kind of forgot about him. So it was a
I wonder good what little... Nancy's doing. Clunk.
Yeah.
Was that the line? Cute. Was it the what was Nancy yeah. doing? Or I was thinking the funniest thing is how
I think he says he's talking to the other girl and he calls her bitch. He says, I can talk to you how I want, bitch, or something like that. And she drives off and then it gets hit in the head. it was like I said, I hadn't seen him and his character is, now, you know.
you did pick up on the fact that he's playing three different characters in this film.
Did he?
Yes.
I didn't notice, really.
He's playing the boyfriend, okay? Then, even though he's got the mask on, you can tell from his voice, he's playing the doctor that Hank is having delusions about with trying to give him shots and everything. That's him. And then he's the guy who actually plays Edgar Allan Poe when Poe.
No, he's not. Adamant. He's not.
Are you sure about that?
No, I'm positive. Me. Nope. It's John Cameron, I believe, played it.
Okay.
You know, one of the other guys who helped work on the project, you know, behind the scenes did that. But he did play another role. I forgot what he was, but he was something else. So he is probably another voice actor or something, you know, in it.
Hmm.
But he did do like three roles, which, I mean, that's called shimping and in Sam Raimi's universe. So
right.
Just sort of like you put a mask on somebody, you can get them to play whoever you want. And a lot of it, if you notice, a lot of it's very Three Stooges like, you know, you Larry slaps Mo, slow Mo slaps, you
and
know,
they all love the Stooges. I mean, all of them. I mean, in fact, the whole what they call the Michigan Mafia, they all love the Stooges. So.
So I have to ask this, Taylor, because have you ever seen like The Evil Dead?
Oh my gosh, I know. I know I should have, but I have not. I know, because it's such a huge play out here. And one of the his name is Ben Stauffer. I believe he played Bruce Campbell's character. And I've seen it, like I know what it is. I don't know why I haven't seen it. Yeah. It's just one of those movies that I missed.
We got to sit you down and watch them from the very first one all the way through. I think you'd really enjoy it.
You know,
how many are there?
There's three of the original. Then there's a remake. And then there's the TV series that they did, Ash versus Evil Dead. And then great. I think they're making a new like movie or something.
Yeah, there was supposed to be a musical too for a while.
Oh, there's also I think that's what she's talking about, right? Like your friend was in the musical, right?
Yeah, they did a musical. I mean, I'm not sure if it like filming wise if they made a musical film, but he did it at I think it was the Tommy Wynn Theater over here. I don't know because of COVID if it's still going on, but they did that show quite a few runs. So. Mm-hmm.
Nice. I love that. Like I love that people are doing Evil Dead the musical. That's sweet. So the funny thing about that is like this is those group, like those people, right. Like Ted Raimi is in Evil Dead, you know, Bruce Campbell, Josh Becker worked on it.
Fruit seller.
Yeah. You gotta see it, Taylor. You love it.
I'll put it on my list. So I'm not watching any TV shows right now, so
it's so funny because those movies are they're very different. Even though there's lots of stuff in there that you can see from Evil Dead, like the claymation stuff and some of the music. I don't know.
Well, Joe LoDuca, who did the score for Evil Dead, and Kay Davis, who did the who edited Evil Dead 2, worked on this film.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You know, and it has an Evil Dead 2 kind of editing to it, you know, like and stuff. So I can get that.
And I can see parallels between Ash and between Hank as well.
I did too. Like I almost felt like this would have been for Bruce Campbell if Bruce wasn't, you know, sort of that famous at that time or sort of like getting there, because I think he just would have turned this down because he can't really, nobody could see him as like a guy that nobody would, you know, or whatever, would normally not get the girl, but, or whatever, like, you know, that kind of thing. But Ted, he's like, he's so good, you know, just put those glasses on him and he's, you know, Paul and I just watched a movie with Ted Raimi in it recently. That was amazing too. But like, I told him, I can't wait for you to watch Lunatics because he's so much bigger in this movie and he deserves a leading role. Like, he deserves to be a lead in a movie.
Yeah, and you rarely ever get a chance to see him, you know, in this much in a film and have this kind of a character. And it was, it was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about the cast a little bit more. So we have Ted Raimi, obviously, as the lead. And we talked like a lot about him. We have
Sam Raimi's brother.
And he's Sam Raimi's brother, and he did a fantastic job. And then we've got the girl who plays Nancy is Deborah Foreman, who we talked about. Bruce Campbell, plays the jerk and the doctor and all that. And then we've got I guess the gangs are sort of big thing, but you didn't really like them, Paul, like at all.
No, they didn't convince me at all.
What did you think about, like, you thought that they were just an LA gang, like, or like an LA actors kind of thing?
Yeah, it was more like this is the sort of thing you show on TV when you want someone to pretend, or someone who's pretending to be a gang, or but then remember from the beginning, remember I told you when we first started talking about this before the show, I was like, this always had a New York feel to me. I didn't.
I thought it was
LA. It's supposed to be LA, but it doesn't feel like LA at all, does it?
Yeah, because he was talking the subway. That's a very New York thing, and just the part. I mean, I guess his apartment was kind of big, but it seemed high up, so I felt New York also.
Mm. Yeah, so it's supposed to be LA, and because they talk about Venice Beach and stuff.
Oh, that's right.
So they talk about It was shot actually in Detroit, Michigan. So it wasn't even filmed in New York. It wasn't filmed in LA. It was filmed mostly entirely in Detroit, which is, I think if I'm correct, and people can correct me if I'm wrong on the comments or anything, but I believe it was filmed in a like abandoned school. So what had happened was they got like permission to rent out the school. And, you know, nobody was doing stuff there. So they had all the different departments that they have for a film, art department, you know, camera crew, everybody in different rooms, like the art room or the, you know, whatever. And
that's
then,
a good idea.
Yeah. And then
instead of buying trailers, smart.
Yeah, exactly. And so then they had to one of the notes that I heard was that Rob Tapper to come down. And one of the things he had said was he wanted he wanted to make his room, you know, was it Ted Raimi's room, bigger, you know, just make it bigger. And they're like, well, if we stretch it out, it's going to go into the gymnasium. That's what they said. And then he said, I don't care, make it bigger, you're gonna thank me later. And they did, and they did thank him later, because it was, I mean, it worked out really well. I thought it was hilarious that he had all his room was just cluttered with all the aluminum foil that he ended up using later. I thought all of that stuff, the aluminum foil and you know, the craziness, that was just perfect to me. Like, I thought,
well, and that was the other thing that kind of was sort of stuck in my craw a little bit, was like, clearly this guy is still suffering from delusions. How is it that he got out of his hospital or his asylum? He says he was there 3.5 years, but clearly he's still having big time issues there.
Yeah, he's not taking his medication or whatever he needs to do, which they never address that he needs like any kind of medication, which I think if it were made today, that would be a big discussion kind of thing, you know. But back in the 90s, I guess everybody always kind of overlooked that, you know.
Maybe that's why he was having all the hallucinations of the doctor. So, you know, that was the medication that he was missing out on. It was subliminal messaging.
Well, I like, too, that the movie is so grounded in 1990. You know, I don't know, Taylor, how old you are, but that was a thing back then, with as far as telephones and telephone lines and party lines and people calling up 900 numbers and paying $2 for the first minute, and then $1 each additional minute for everything you can think of. I mean, you would have like confession lines, you would have
psychic,
date lines, psychic lines. You had all kinds of stuff. This is stuff that actually happened. And if you were to stay up and like watch the Late Show, you would see nothing but commercials for all of these weird different telephone lines that you could actually do. And it's such a thing. And of course, you know, once mobile phones come out, that's the end of all that.
Yeah, I grew up in the 90s, so I'm familiar with some of it. And like, yeah, if you would stay up late, the phone numbers, I remember they would be on the like really, really late night. So and very questionable, you know, kind of stuff. But yeah, I definitely, I got the vibes. And then when you were talking about the gangsters earlier, it was funny. One of the things I noticed, one of the gangsters was wearing his handkerchief really weird. He wore like, I think he wore like backwards on his neck. So it looked like a little, like almost like a little cardigan, how they do with the cardigans with the sleeves on the front. I thought it was, so, I was like, why did he wear it? I didn't know if it was a style choice or I was like, yeah, they're not very intimidating.
That might've been a 90s like look, you know, or whatever.
It kind of stuck out to me and I'm like,
I just remember at the time, I think the movie Colors came out and, yeah, they were not similar at all.
You know, it's funny because what is it? I think Deborah Foreman looked more like a gang member with her like leather jacket.
And, I know. You know,
she looked more like a gang member than they did.
She did. And you know what? She wasn't a pushover either. I mean, you know, she seemed kind of like a fish out of water from Iowa and all that kind of thing. But, you know, when push comes to shove, she grabbed the gun from the guy's waistband and fired it a couple of times, shot the guy in the foot. You know, I mean, she was not a pushover. And I like to see that. She wasn't some weeping violet, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and she didn't like, and okay. So I want to talk about this because like the way that I saw, I love the structure of this film, like the beginning of the movie, you see like both of them separately, what's going on with them. The second act, they get together. Third act, she leaves and he has to go on the adventure to find her, you know, but what I really liked about it, and this goes to what you're just saying, Paul, is that the beginning of the, you know, when beginning of like the third act, when she leaves, she had basically saved his life in a way by kind of making him feel like he can actually do this. He can go out into the world, you know, so he musters everything he can. He defeats the doctor, you know, and he, you know, destroys them. And that's level one of his video game world that he's now like thrown into. So then he goes into level two where he's outside and his stuff starts happening. He goes to all these different levels he has to defeat. And then she saves him from the spider, you know, right? Which aka the garbage truck. By the way, Paul, I don't know if you know this, caught this or not, but Gary Jones, director of Jolly Roger, was the driver of the truck. So anyway, so later he, you know, he has to save her, you know, from the gang member and everything, which he does, you know. Too bad that guy's got a metal plate in his head and, you know, it doesn't.
Yeah, that was a little convenient too.
It was funny though. It was sort of funny because like, you know, it bounced off his head and he was like, you know, whatever. But, you know, it didn't stop him, you know, he could, you know, all this different stuff could have stopped him, but, so they end up kind of winning together and saving each other's lives. And well, that was cute.
Here's the other movie that it reminded me of. And this is going to come out of left field, but I can't help it. Tell me that Hank doesn't a little bit remind you of Kyle from Hobgoblins. The same thing, calling up the phone, getting a fantasy thing going on, being a nebbish, you know, having to have to try and come out of his shell. You know, for the girl, and then, you know, in Kyle's case, it doesn't work, but, you know, in Hank's case, it does, and it there's a little bit of Kyle.
I mean, it's enough where maybe that's a thing, you know, that was happening back in that time, because I think was Hobgoblins was 89 or 88, something like that, 88, and this was
when it came out, but I think it was shot in like 85 86.
Interesting thing is this is actually written in 88, started writing in 88. That's when he That's when Josh Becker started writing it on his Apple IIc computer, you know. So I don't know if you guys know about that, but those are like the really, really, really like whatever. And he wrote like all these pages and he couldn't save it. He'd have to like, you know, or whatever. And then his power went off. And he lost a bunch and he got mad. It was the power guy, the DWP man. And he was like, the DWP man was like, you didn't pay your bill. And he goes, I did. And he showed him the bill and everything. And he looked at the work order, goes, oops, sorry, wrong address.
Oh my God, no.
That's terrible.
No wonder it took, 11 scripts.
probably a lot of that might have happened. I don't know. But yeah, I'm glad that, and you know what, and Paul always tells me like, that sometimes the scripts need to keep getting rewritten until it's good. You know, a lot of times in indie filmmaking, that does not happen.
Right.
They just do the first draft and then they like throw it out there.
Yeah.
And
stuff either just gets overlooked or they just don't care or, you know, little things. I mean, little things sometimes can really, really stand out. For example, like how the heck is Hank able to afford that apartment? Well, I mean, he's not working. Where is he getting his money from to get an apartment in LA when he never leaves it and he does nothing but write poetry all day and notebooks? Okay, so where's that money coming from?
There's the food and the water also.
Yeah, how does he pay his bills? Because it's not like everything's online like it was now, you know, like that. See, this could work for today because like if they remade this today, which I'm not saying, hey, Josh Becker, sorry, I'm not saying somebody should remake this. I'm just saying if they did remake this today, this would work. Absolutely.
You never need to go to your mailboxes. It doesn't matter anymore.
Exactly. Because everything's email, you know, and everything. So all you'd have to need is a computer, you know, right? And he could do everything. And online delivery, all this stuff, everything that this guy, and you could use the example that he actually has a job, you know, that he does from home, whatever. Sure. But you're absolutely right. And it was a thought in my head of like, how does he afford to like do all this stuff when I don't see him going out and doing a job for 6 months? He hasn't left his apartment unless he's literally had enough money saved up. And like there's got to be more of a story
from being in the hospital for 3.5 years.
Which that would be hard too, because that's not for free unless his parents are paying for that.
Yeah, so maybe his parents might be paying for everything because they did say they would fly him out because he was saying something. So his parents may be paying for everything. That would be the only suggestion and thought that I could think
clarify that a little bit.
It would have been great if on the mother was on the phone, was like, you know, look, you're using up our last dime, you know, so I want you to come home and see your brother, you know, so that we can talk about, you know, whatever, something like that or whatever, you know.
But the good thing is that the movie is good enough and interesting enough and the actors are really good enough that it's okay. Even though I picked that up, I'm like, you know, I'm all right with it. It's all right. Yeah. There's better things going on. And I when a movie's like that and you like it, you're much more in a forgiving mood. At least I am.
I am too.
Or if a movie I don't like and it really irritates me, this is going to irritate me even more. And it's just going to make me go, rah, 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 and I get pissed off over details like that. But it's a lot more forgiving when it's a well-done movie and when the intentions are there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
definitely.
I think since you were talking about the phone call, I think that was one of the things I noticed, that the timeline seemed a little bit off, or they could have added to it where, so when he's talking to his mom, she's telling him, or he says the wrong brother's getting married. She said, no, it's this brother. So if he's only been gone for 6 months, you know, both your brothers are engaged. That seems like a really short amount of time for everything to happen. I don't know. It just seemed a little like unrealistic on that, like if I'm nitpicking it a little bit.
And then she's like, what are you getting married? And like, thanks, Mom.
I actually absolutely love that. So here's a great story. I'm going to read this real quick if you guys don't mind, but this is from Josh himself talking about it. Because he wrote in his book Rushes, the making of Lunatic's a Love Story. And in the story, he said, the bad decision that Rob Tapper made was that we were having difficulty making the schedule work out between day and night shoots. Rob said, that's easy. Instead of it becoming night at that scene, have it become night a scene later. And there you go. Your schedule works. Except that I had big plans for the sunset scene that got scrapped for no good, real good reasons. I had planned on having it become sunset during Hank's long phone conversation with his mother that not only never cuts to the mother, but never cuts at all, nor does the camera move for about 5 minutes, a very long time in a movie. That and what was going to make this scene spectacular was that during the course of that 5 minute conversation, the sunlight coming through the window would constantly be moving down, casting longer and longer shadows until it finally changes from night to day, leaving the depressed Hank in a bluish twilight. It would have been great, but it was now not to be. The executive producer had made the change to the schedule, and that was that. Well, without the lighting effect, the scene is just too damn long and not covered properly. I ended up having to get a shot of Hank's feet later, so that I was able to cut into the scene and delete some of the dialogue that now went on too long, but it could have been beautiful.
Wow, of course, it's always the producer, I swear.
Trial and travails of indie filmmaking.
I know, the producer's probably right at that particular time about, like, you know, this is how you fix that scheduling problem, but mm-hmm. then you kind of screw over, like, a beautiful shot that would have probably looked really cool or something, you know.
But why not just film it out of order, like, you know what I mean? Whenever I film, we never really shoot the film in order. You could start at the end. They could have done all the day shoots and then all the night shoots and split it up that way. Would have made it, like, that would be one way to do it, or, you know, a week, or like come back, do shoot that scene last so they could get that on a night shoot.
Yeah, I mean, they had a month to film this, apparently, which is actually long. And they had, say,
for an indie production, that's long.
Oh, and they had a week worth of rehearsals, which he's never had that on any other film set he's ever worked on.
He's not the only one.
Yeah. So, So literally, Kevin Smith does that all the time, but like that's literally, you know, has to be budgeted into to the film, you know, because you have to fly the actors out or whatever, and you have to go. But it was literally just those three, you know, the Ted, Deborah, and Bruce, you know, together or whatever. Everybody else didn't need to be in the rehearsals, and mainly it was the scene with them in the apartment, that long 30 minutes of them talking. Which, I mean, did you guys notice that, like, went on like 30 minutes of them just chit-chatting and getting
married? Oh,
I mean, which is actually not that bad, you know, because at the time just went like that, you know, to me. Like, I didn't even notice.
It's interesting because I'm surprised. I would have thought you would have felt it was a little stagey, because I know you don't like movies where they don't change the setting very often.
Well, okay. I've talked about this on, I guess, a lot of discussions on other stuff. I don't like movies where the whole movie takes place in one location. Sometimes I will forgive it. Like, there's a movie Richard Linklater did called Tape that I love. Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat, like things like that. I can forgive it if it's done well, where I care about the characters I'm interested. Movies like Witch House, you know, done by David Dakota, I freaking hate it because it's so boring, because we're in this one location and, like, it doesn't feel stagey, it just feels boring, you know. And if the movie has interesting characters, I can forgive that, you know, and whatnot, and I like that.
You know how it is, though. I mean, Witch House especially, we have this great house probably for free, let's take advantage of it and shoot the whole damn thing here.
No, I get it. It's just, you know, let's have some fun with it, or have fun with the characters, or introduce things that I've never seen before. Everything was just so boring and trite for some stuff. So as long as it's done well, I will forgive it.
Well, you know, if it hadn't been for, you know, Hank's delusions, that broke it up an awful lot.
Yes.
I probably would have felt it was got a little staged and I probably been a little annoyed, but because his delusions were so extreme and they were physically altering his room, at least in his mind, it was enough to break all that up. So I thought that that was a very, very wise use of his mental sort of hallucinations.
So speaking of his delusions, Taylor, I talked to Paul about this earlier, but what did you think of the rap group in the movie?
Oh, the rap group. It felt a little random. it was, I wasn't expecting him to have that type of music. He, you know, with someone who writes poetry, well, I mean, I guess I could expect him to have rap because, like, you know, rap, you know, is lyrical stuff, but he just doesn't strike me as that. I thought he would listen to like classical music. so it was just a little weird for me.
I think it was only the only reason it was in there was so that he could get his head, like, you know, put on the was a turntable and, you know, and everything. Yeah. Like that was like one of the, that was one of the better parts of it, is him doing that. But they did like a couple times.
I wasn't wild about the rap group and I wasn't wild about the wonky acid jazzy kinds of stuff in the beginning. You know, it's just not my thing. And it's like, yeah, I kind of wish they'd left that back in 1990, but you know, it's a product of its time. So that's what happens.
Definitely. It was is definitely, it all felt 90s. Like this whole movie felt like one big long, and I think that's what I liked about it the most.
Don's Plum, that was the other one where it had that wonky acid jazzy kind of music that you don't hear anymore, but it was that period of time when it was there.
The saxophones.
Yes. Yeah. The first movie, I think you're saying, talking about like the credits, right? Where the everything. Yeah. Wonderful. I mean, I love that kind of music too, in those kind of movies, you know, like it feels like that specific style of, like, I guess it was like hip, you know, like hipster type music, you know, back then or whatever. And I dug it. Especially because it's used well with like shots, you know, like where they can make it sort of where all of a sudden they push in on like person's face or something when the thing goes, you know, like makes a little, you know what I mean? Like it can go well with editing, in my opinion, you know, as used in Don's Plum, but not as well much in this, you know. Then this was just like the beginning, you know, credits and whatnot, just to show it's a 90s film. You know, because that was the feel of it. And that's what I like. I love, like, my favorite decade right now is the 90s. And I absolutely adore the 90s.
It actually reminded me a little bit of Joe's Apartment, too. Just the way the whole thing is structured around this one apartment that he just never wants to leave and all the weird shit that goes on. And it's also roughly the same period.
Right. And I think Joe's Apartment was after this. So maybe they saw Lunatics a Love Story and decided to do their own, you know, thing, similar story, just with Jerry Connell, I think, was in that movie, which he hasn't really been a lead ever since. You know, like he's usually the, you know, a background guy in the movie.
Well, I mean, at least as far as Joe's Apartment goes, I mean, that got pummeled by the critics. And, you know, I don't recall what happened with Lunatics, A Love Story. I don't know that it made much of a headway. Like I said, I remember it came out. I remember my friends were like, this is a movie you would probably really dig. You should go check it out. And then I ended up going to see something else and I forgot about it. And that was that. But I don't recall if it was how it was looked at or how it was rated or anything like that. I know Darkman was like a big deal, you know?
Let me get it real quick. Like there's actually a thing about the end of the movie. What happened with it? Let me see. It said, meanwhile, Columbia TriStar released Lunatics, A Love Story directly to cable TV and videotape.
There you go.
It showed quite a few times, possibly 50 on the premium channels in 1993. It was then released to a video at a cost of $99.95 and it sold rather poorly, about 5,000 copies, if I heard correctly. Then the film disappeared off the face of the earth. In 1995, I was visiting a friend in Gore, New England, which was down at the very bottom of the country, 15 miles from Antarctica. We went into the local video shop, and there was a new release shelf, was Lunatics A Love Story, which was brand new, much improved artwork on the video box. My friend had already seen it and rented it. At some point in the year 2000, inexplicably, Lunatics A Love Story began popping up on cable television again. It was since seemingly found a home on the Starz Encore Love Story channel, where it has shown at least 100 times. For whatever reason, Lunatics A Love Story has never been released on DVD. So,
and it never got a theatrical release, huh?
No, I guess
then
not.
Then how did people watch it?
Cable.
HBO, probably, yeah.
Yeah, or Starz, it seems, you know, or whatever, Starz. So, you know, channel like TV. I mean, nowadays it would be streaming, you know, or whatever.
Right.
It's funny how a lot of movies from that period, you know, 80s and 90s, just kind of vanished. Even, you know, I was talking about how this reminded me so much of After Hours. I mean, that's Martin Scorsese. I don't think that's ever been released on Blu-ray. You never hear anybody talking about After Hours, but I remember it. I loved it. And yeah, it's just crazy.
Should it be a Hollywood Knockbuster episode?
Maybe. Was there just like possibly not a budget? I mean, you said it was a low budget, but I mean, even $600,000 is a lot more than some of the low budgets I've worked on.
Oh, yeah.
Like if I had $600,000 now, you know, I'd be happy, you know. back then, that's like I said, that's like the equivalent of $1 million to $2 million, you know, of what it would be now, you know. So that's amazing.
Let's reshoot it for 600K and we can star Tommy Wiseau and Britney Spears.
I don't know if we could get Britney, but
you know what? She her father just got off her conservatorship, so she's making her own decisions. So
she's
maybe
available.
Yeah. Maybe she'll start doing acting again. I don't know. I always adored her as an actress. I'm sorry. She's funny. She's really good at comedy too. So she would be good for that. She would be the perfect Deborah Foreman. Like she has that kind of look and that, you know, geez, that's good casting. Now Tommy Wiseau, no. You know.
Oh, come on.
Put it out there. Let her know. She's got some connects.
I don't know, though. I don't know who owns the rights to this now, because Columbia TriStar did, but I don't know how long they've owned the
Nancy,
rights for.
You are tearing me apart.
So, like, all in all, I mean, so you guys really enjoyed this film, right? Like, you know, like compared
to, I liked it.
You know, what?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You know, and I told you it was different, but did I tell you it was good, or did I tell you, like good different, or did I just tell you it was different?
You like just told me it was different.
Okay, so you had no idea, you know.
Yeah, I had. Well, you said you're lucky. I usually pick more brutal stuff, and so I was like, oh, thank God, because I was like, I didn't know what you meant by like brutal, because like when it comes to gory stuff, it's like I mean, it's funny because I do it all the time, but when I have to watch it, I'm like cringing. And I'm like, can't watch it.
Yeah, we don't really do a whole lot of gory stuff. We just do things that are, you know, some of the stuff we do is really just terrible.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So when he said that, since this was my first time, I was just like, oh, compared to what?
Well, yeah, you did get off light. Lydia got off light with Haggard, and yet she didn't like it. So I wasn't sure how this would go over. I still don't think she would have liked this movie either. You know,
I usually toss them right into the deep end with something really weird and stinky, because that's what I do.
Right off the bat, which was Jen's first thing was Suburban Sasquatch, right?
Suburban Sasquatch.
Like, oh, Lord.
Nothing, no.
Yeah. You've never seen that one, have you?
I have not. It sounds interesting, though.
We'll have to get you that for our Patreon only. You'll have to come on and watch that and review that.
Oh,
one.
Man. You know? Live reactions.
Oh, yeah. We've got tons of fun stuff.
Yes. So with that being said, we're down to our rating and review section of it. And so I just want to thank you, Taylor, because this is awesome. This has been great. So we're going to Paul is going to explain the stinkometer to everybody.
Okay, so as some of you might know, we do have a stinkometer in which we rate our film from a 1 to a 10, where a 1 is a very, very low score if you think that it's a very good film. 5 is kind of like, oh, it's not too bad, mediocre. And then 10 is an awful big giant stinky cow pie. So basically, the higher the score, the stinkier and worse the movie is. That doesn't necessarily mean that you dislike it. We happen to thoroughly enjoy some of our most stinkiest films, but mm-hmm. then that's the kind of people that we are. And if you feel kind of subtle, you can give it a half point. So you could go like a 3.5 or a 5.5 or an 8.5, something like that. And then once we get three scores, we add them up and then we check it out, how it matches up with everything else that's been done in the season. And then we figure out which movie's the stinkiest movie of the season.
Yep, exactly. All right. So, Paul, I'm going to let you go first. You know, I normally would say maybe Taylor, but I'm gonna give Paul. Paul, the
sounds good, so I can make sure my ratings.
Oh, because you're still new. We like to give our new people like the chance to like, you know, hear from us first and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a pretty good film. I mean, it does have a few issues that I mentioned and a few things that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, but overall, you know, I mean, I like all the stuff that these guys do in general. I really kind of dug it. I mean, the people who said this is the kind of movie that you would like, it was like, yep, they were right. This is a kind of movie that I liked. It does remind me an awful, awful lot of After Hours, which is a good thing because I like that film. And it, you know, like I said, it does have a few little issues. I'm going to probably give it a 4.
I think that's a decent
score. Yeah.
All right. You're going to be surprised. Maybe. I don't know. With my score, I'm giving it a 1. This is my first 1. So when I was watching it, I didn't talk about this earlier because I wanted to save this for this. When I was watching it, I was smiling the whole time. Like everything happening was so cute and funny and, you know, everything just made me all warm and fuzzy inside. I don't know. This movie just made me happy. So I wanted to give it a 1. Like this is the first time I think in the history of all of Indie Film Cafe that I've ever given anything a 1. I think, period. Nobody's ever given a 1 yet.
I think Arcade or one of the movies you did with Dustin got a 1.
Maybe from Dustin, yeah, I think. You know, but I don't think I've ever given it anything a 1. And so this was my 1 so far.
This hits you in the warm and fuzzies, huh?
It did. Well, all the 90s and all that stuff just made me feel good. So, Taylor, it's your turn. So feel free to say whatever your score is.
All right. Don't hate on me, but I think I would give it a 5.5. I think, like, I enjoyed it. I felt like some of the scenes could have, like, more things could have been explained, like we were talking about with the job and stuff like that. I feel like there was, like, little subtle things that were off. Not that it was super realistic, but it's kind of hard when we're going through the craziness of it, like him not just like her not being totally off put by him. Like it was just a little off in some aspects for me, but I did enjoy it. I thought it was fun. I liked how she didn't right away warm up to him either. I felt like they did a good pace on that. And I thought that I really enjoyed all the scenes where he, where you're seeing what he hallucinates, because I felt like that really put it into perspective for you. I enjoyed all the stuff with the doctor. But I thought it was like cute and goofy. So not the typical movie I watched. So that's probably like why my rating's kind of like neutral, I would say. But I think it was well done, just off a little bit in certain areas. It could have been longer. I think it should have been longer to explain more, I guess.
Interesting.
That was a very, very good answer to that. Cause like, you know, whenever we show people, like, you know, a lot of people that we bring in sometimes don't even like indie films, you know, or whatever, this is not their back, you know? So this isn't the type of movie they go out and search for. Me and Paul, this is what we bonded over, you know, this is what, you know, so we kind of like to bring in people who are new, who whatever, you know, I totally understand the 5.5 rating for it.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you thought it should be longer. Most of the time we could deal with people who say, oh, this movie should have been shorter by at least half an hour.
No, I just felt like they could have added to the backstory a little bit more in some areas. So for me, I don't want it to be 4 hours long, but it could have probably been, if it was like maybe 20, 30 minutes longer, I think that would have been perfect. But then again, I guess the ending got cut for us, so I don't know how much extra that was.
Well, I'm not surprised that Moody said that this had gone through a lot of edits. I think the movie kind of shows that it went through a lot of edits. The interesting thing to me is that you said that they went back to edit number 5, and that, you know, because who knows what they did in the other edits. It may have been cleaned up more, but somewhere along the line, it may have lost, you know, the heart that was in the film. And so yeah. While it's definitely has a few issues and it's definitely missing some stuff, I think that it managed to achieve getting the heart of the story, which is these two lovable misfits falling in love and, you know, just kind of going through this whole process and all that. I think they managed to keep that part of the story alive.
I forgot to mention this before, but this might explain something, you know, too, for you guys. But with each new draft, Rob kept pushing the tone it down to PG-13 approach harder and harder, causing me to finally ask, aren't we making an edgy, low-budget independent movie? The response I got still puzzles me. Rob said, papacize it, meaning turn it into pap, is mushy, semi-liquid infant food or undemanding reading material. Why anyone
make it bland?
What?
You wanted to make it bland?
Yeah. So he goes, why would anyone want to intentionally turn their work into mush was and is still entirely beyond me. However, you want to get the movie made. So
he did. Oh, yeah. He wanted to you know, get Hollywood behind it, I think. That's probably the only thing I can think of, is to make it less edgy, less interesting.
Yeah.
From what I gather from his thing too, is also that's what was happening with Universal and Darkman, was they were telling him go less, you know.
I had heard about that with Darkman, and frankly I was somewhat disappointed with Darkman. Darkman had a big sort of following by the time I saw it, and when I finally did saw it, I was like, yeah, this is okay. It wasn't what I was expecting. I was hoping for better, you know.
I found out that the Coen brothers added to the draft of that script, you know, so uncredited, but they are, you know, yeah. So there's some interesting stuff like this book. If you guys are big fans of this movie, or you're big fans of Josh Becker period, you like maybe Running Time or especially Thou Shalt Not Kill, except how ridiculously silly it is and fun. It is. It's definitely a different movie than this one. If you like that, go buy his book, Rushes. They have making ofs, everything. I mean, I love this book. It's basically a how-to book, you know, on filmmaking as well. So really cool.
That's really cool. But did you mention that this movie does not have a DVD release?
That's what it said back then when he wrote the making of. So it may have gotten a DVD release since. You know, but I think it last I looked on online, there was no available DVD, and the only DVD was there, it wasn't even actual, it wasn't even Lunatics of Love Story, some Korean movie that they said also you could get, you know. So I don't know, I don't think there is an actual DVD release.
Oh, that's a shame.
Which, if I don't know who owned it, Columbia or somebody, TriStar, if they actually, if they still own it or whatever, maybe like Shout Factory or somebody can get into their vaults and see if they can re-release it, you know, because it deserves, you know, it deserves a release with like a director's commentary with Josh and
or a Blu-ray. Like, I'd love to see a Blu-ray release.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, Lorber, someone like that.
Nobody actually puts out just DVDs anymore. If they if they release this stuff, they'll put out Blu-ray or 4K. It would look beautiful in 4K. I mean, I would definitely get a copy of that. So I want a copy of this movie. Unfortunately, the only way we have it is on like YouTube right now, or a VHS copy, which, yeah. You know, I think they're hard to find, you know, even on Amazon. So
it's just one of the many, many, many movies of the period that just never made the transition into DVD or Blu-ray or anything past that, unfortunately.
Yep.
And that's why you gotta love some of these other releasing companies that will come by and will actually buy the rights to make a release. because that's the only other way. I mean, the you know, I don't see Universal doing it. It's, no one's going to, you know, that's not anything that anyone's demanding. So it's not going to give them any more money.
Right.
And especially since we're like going into the streaming and stuff, people are buying less DVDs. I only have a handful of DVDs myself. Like we had a bunch of VHSs growing up, probably in stores somewhere. But like as far as DVDs go, I think I probably have like five, and they have to be movies that I really, really like.
And that's funny because you were talking to two folks who love our physical medium. We like to collect it because when you've got the physical medium, you have complete control over it forever. Won't go away.
Right. And it's funny. It's funny you guys mentioned that because I was at a Dollar Tree today picking up some dollar ones because we, Paul and I, do a haul video. So we like pick up these movies, and I got like 21 of them or something. And I had them all like, you know, lined up. And this lady goes, "What are you going to do with all those?" I was like, "I collect them." And then I told her,
"Come see our studio."
I said, "We do a video where we talk about them and everything." And I was like, "And sometimes I actually watch them." And she started laughing when I said that. Like, but it's true. Like, sometimes I don't watch them. Most of the time I don't, because there's just too many to, you know.
But someday, Taylor,
they're movies, like at the dollar store.
Yeah, at the Dollar Tree, there are movies, and Dollar General, all the dollar places, they actually have movies, you know.
My first thought is, I don't know if you watched the Amanda Show, but I was thinking they were like the remakes that she does in her, that comedy show. Did you watch the Amanda Show?
Years ago, the Amanda Bynes show.
Yes. She would have a little skit where they would go to, you know, movie gallery or whatever movie, you know, the movie shops that they had, Blockbuster, and then someone would go in to rent X-Men, but it would be them, her and her coworkers reenacting it really terribly. And so then the people would be like really mad because they'd be like, "This is an X-Men." They're like, "Yeah, it is. Look." But it's sort of a terrible reenactment. I don't know. That was my first thought when you said dollar, our movies at the dollar store. I'm like,
nice.
That actually reminds me of that movie Be Kind Rewind with Jack Black, where they lost all the, they owned their video store and they lost all the movies. So they had to reenact every one of them. And then they pulled them out and everybody loved them because they're just so bad, like, and so fun. But like, yeah, that's amazing. I don't know. We love the Dollar Tree.
Someday, Taylor, you're gonna have to come out to Virginia and come to the studio and then see the mountain of movies that we've got there between the two of us.
Yeah.
All right, it'll have to be a random selection of the weirdest ones. You know, you're gonna have to pick the top.
Oh boy, oh boy, that's what I want to hear.
See, we're turning her into a co-host for us. Yay. You know.
Oh, I enjoy a good strange movie. Have you guys seen? There's this one. Oh God, it was so when we were selling Immortal Wars, it came out too. It was very cheesy. It was I wish I remember what it was called. It was similar in the sense to Immortal Wars, where it was like a game show, but it had dinosaurs in it. And nice. They had to fight dinosaurs. And it even has, oh God, I think the guy that was in that Disney movie, Luck of the Irish, the main character, I don't know his name. I think he was in it. So they had a known actor in it. And so there's this one scene where this guy, he's got nunchucks, I think, and he's fighting like five dinosaurs. And it's just like,
outstanding.
It's absolutely ridiculous, but it's so entertaining. And I think that's what they're going for. So I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed it going in thinking I was going to like hate it. You know, I was like, "Oh, this is going to be so stupid, but I have to watch it." So I did. And I actually, like, it had some good pieces to it, especially that part.
I mean, you know, Velocipaster and Zombievers and all that kind of stuff. That's our, you know, kind of stuff.
Yeah, we like the goofier, the sillier, the better. As long as you know you are. And sometimes when you don't know you are, like The Room, Tommy probably thought he was making a good movie when he made
Neil Breen.
He always thinks he's making great movies. Let's be quiet though. If he listens to one of our podcasts, he might not come on our interview.
Neil Breen knows exactly what's going on, but it's okay because Neil Breen has an army of admirers and people who will, you know, bankroll his movies. I'm one of them, so he knows. He understands. He's happy. Yeah. He's like, he's doing what he wants to do.
We'd have to show you a Neil Breen movie someday because your mind will be blown.
Sounds good. There's so many movies out there that I feel like I haven't seen, and everyone's like, you haven't seen this? I'm like, listen, there's so much stuff out there, and being an adult takes a lot of time.
Exactly. There was a whole show. It doesn't exist anymore. Well, I mean, it exists still on YouTube, but she doesn't do it anymore. But there was a girl, Tamara Chambers, who would do Tamara's Never Seen.
Yeah, and that's right.
She's never seen like so many movies, you know, like that everybody. I think that whole crew got like, I mean, they have problems or something. She's barely on it. Like she'll show up as like a special guest or something, but she does, I think, her own stuff or whatever. But anyway, she does the show and where she would just say, you know, I've never seen this movie. I haven't seen that movie. And then she'd watch it. Right. Mm-hmm. And then she would give her like, you know, thoughts on the movie and everything, like what her expectations were for it. You know, did she think
she did The Godfather of all things? I couldn't believe that one.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, she does movies that like every popular movies, and then she did a Neil Breen movie once. So, she loved it. Awesome. She loved it, and she thought it was the greatest thing she'd ever seen, and became like a fan of his after that. So, sure. And we've been fans of his since, you know. Sure. And so, I mean, except Jen, I don't think she's a fan of him.
Well, it might be because I bought her this shirt that has Neil Breen's face.
You bought me it too, so I mean, whatever.
He's like, I'm wearing it right now.
I'm not, sadly.
I try to get him to wear it; he won't do it.
I'll wear it like when we do like the big like parties or whatever, but like just
Christmas
a natural
Halloween. Come
yeah,
on.
It is not. It's no, literally, it's not just his head. It's like his head like a million times on this whole shirt.
Oh, nothing. Nice.
Yeah. So it's like his face all over it and in the back, everywhere. Just the whole shirt has nothing but Neil Breen's face.
As it should like, be.
Oh, whatever. anyway, we're done with the podcast, but. I just want, once again, Taylor, you are awesome for your first time out here. Like I said, like I told you before, I was giving you an easy one. Sometimes I like to break in, like my friends, you know, who I know and I don't want to lose. I break them in softly. Paul doesn't seem to care when it's his friends. He's like, they should know better. So he likes to do that, but you don't really.
So are you going to come back for other shows?
I would love to come back if you guys will have me. I want something weird next time. I want something.
Yes.
Something, you know, like what we were talking about earlier. What was it? You named a couple of, like, it sounded like giant bug things or stuff like that. That sounds interesting. So.
Definitely.
I'll find you a really good fun stinker and we'll see how you like it.
All right. Yeah, that definitely. Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you so much. If you stick around, but everybody listening, I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. Let us know what you guys think in the comments. Also check out our Patreon at patreon.com/indiefilmcafe. We have a really good exclusive podcast and we've got one coming up with Paul. So good God, I don't know what that's going to be, but Paul's going to pick something a lot of fun for you guys with exclusive content this month. And thank you guys so much. And I hope you guys enjoy it. And check out Lunatics a Love Story if you haven't seen it already. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Hi, kitty.
Sorry, I didn't think she would do that.
That's okay.